Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us and making sure our microphones are working.
And mine as well.
Yep, it looks like it's good.
Cha-cha-cha.
All right, we're here to talk about The Reaping. released in 2007.
It is a movie.
It's a movie.
That was released in 2007. We'll get into that.
Katie chose it.
I'm going to own that.
I'm just letting you know.
Yeah.
Ooh. I found a ring in my...
Just now?
No, like in my bin. My husband is... I know I'm not supposed to say what's new with me, but my husband's been purging and trying to organize my life. So this is a ring I had when I was in high school, and I always loved it. Because it's very, like, stained glass looking. Mm-hmm. And I was like, maybe Charlotte would want it, but she might think it's trash, and then I'll just keep it for myself.
There you go.
Anyway. It's on this table, so to remind myself to offer it to her later.
And then be hurt, deeply hurt from her rejection.
I think this is garbage, and any person who wore this in the 90s is a piece of trash. Or no, the early aughts.
There you go.
Okay, so it's been a while since we've seen each other.
Yeah, several weeks.
I know nothing of note has happened.
No. The world is just as it was.
What's new with you?
Actually, I have kind of a fun ring story myself. I'm wearing a new ring today because Tom and I have been together for 22 years.
Aww.
And
your wedding pictures, you look like you stole your outfits and took, be a fun little joke.
Seventh grader.
You look like middle schoolers. And you got your friends and family to participate in the joke.
Yeah, they all played along.
Yeah.
No, but it's interesting that every now and then we do stumble across something that we don't know about each other. And for me, what just made me think of this is, something I was doing recently was, going through a giant bin of stuff that I had, that belonged to my grandmother on my mom's side. And then also her husband and her parents. Because when she died, my mom was still alive and my mom basically just moved all of my Nana's stuff into her house. But then when my mom died, I had to clean out that house. So these are the things that I determined in that flurry of, a nightmare time in my life. These are things that I need to keep and then go through later.
The double whammy of here's some crap I kept and then I'll die and here's some more crap.
Yeah.
Double crap.
Yeah. You can go through the same crap second time. My mom has a half sister that I have never met because they didn't have a relationship, but we became friends on Facebook. And she reached out to me recently asking about a particular thing, artifact from, their family's history to see if I had it. And I didn't think I did, but I was like, I should double check this bin of things that I had kept, just in case I do. Cause it's a pretty interesting thing. My mom's dad, she actually never even met him because he was a pilot. He was stationed in Alaska with the Air Force, and he died in a plane crash. Not actually in a crash itself, but they were going down. His co-pilot and his navigator bailed out. He was able to land the plane, but obviously was no longer operational. And so he ended up surviving 7 days with the wreckage of the plane and froze to death. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they couldn't find it faster than that. I mean, this was 1951, so it's not like this was the 1800s. How would you locate
Haven't
a plane?
Haven't you heard of Amelia Earhart? Only 8 short years before that.
Indeed.
No. Is it? I don't know.
I have no idea.
I know. It's wild.
But anyway, and so there was a note that he had written to his commanding officer, to my grandmother, his wife, and that was found with his body. And my grandmother obviously kept it her whole life. It was a very precious thing that she had. She actually, I remember her having it in a safety deposit box, but I don't know, you know, where it went after that between her and my mom and her possessions and everything. And by the time I was cleaning out my mom's house, I never came across it. Anyway, so that was the item that I was looking for. Did not find it, but I did encounter a that same grandfather's Air Force ring, which is very cool. He obviously wore it to death because it's like almost rubbed smooth a couple of the insignia on it. And it fit my thumb. And so just kind of on a whim, I started wearing it on my thumb once or twice, like last week. And Tom goes, why are you wearing a thumb ring? And I was like, I don't know. I just thought it would be kind of fun.
The '90s are back.
I know. Well, and I was like, I used to wear a thumb ring every day. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, my shark ring. And he's like, what are you talking about?
Who are you?
Yeah. And so then I launch into this whole tale because I had this shark ring. And there are many, you know, he was very lucky to hear several stories associated with it, including obtaining it in Tijuana when I was in fifth grade.
Is it like a shark, like a swimming shark, or a shark like a hockey team shark?
Like a swimming shark.
Okay.
And so it was a ring that I got in Tijuana that was too big for any other finger. So I wore it on my thumb, like all through high school. It was like, you know, just part of me. My thumb is actually was kind of misshapen from wearing it as long as I did. And then tragically, I lost it by taking it off to wash my hands in a bathroom in Zion National Park and leaving it sitting next to the sink. So somehow Tom had never heard this story. This had never come up in the 22 years we've been together. And so then he left.
I used to be a different woman.
I know. He said when I was like, I didn't realize that I lost it before I met you. And he's like, yeah, we probably would not have started dating if you were still wearing a thumb ring. It's like, whatever, dick. But yeah, so last Thursday night, he left on a red eye flight with my son to Boston for hockey. And when I came home from school on Thursday afternoon, there was a box next to the bed and in it was a shark ring. Mm-hmm. So after this conversation, evidently he went online and found, and it's a small feminine one that fits my ring finger as opposed to the big honking man's ring that I wore on my thumb for 8 years, which is nice because I would actually wear this one. Mm-hmm. But it was a very sweet gesture.
Oh, that is nice. Yeah. Just little surprises.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Very clever guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what's new with you?
I mean, school.
Black.
You know, I finished my report cards. It's conference week's next week.
Yeah, we had our report cards published yesterday.
Yeah. So I'll be doing that. You know, it's always kind of, it's fine. It's fine. You know, I don't like dislike meeting with parents. It's just like a lot of talking for me. So it's makes me tired. Yeah. So it's not like the people or anything where I'm like, ugh. I'm just like, oh, I'm just tired. And also, as you know, I'm kind of an introverted person, so it takes a lot of...
Even more out of you than it does.
Yeah, a lot of capital, basically, for me to cash out in a short amount of days. You're like,
I need a week off after this.
Pretty much. I'm just like, I feel like a Victorian... You know, paintings where I'm like having layabouts on different couches.
Finally, I need a fainting couch.
I know. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, I'm just so tired. I'm so drained. But I got my report cards done, so that's good. Then I also listened to an audiobook called, it was really crazy, it's called Suffer the Children, and it kind of felt like a Stephen King kind of book. Uh-huh. It was, I'll give you the shorts, it's like kind of in a synopsis that you'd find, it's like, I don't feel like it's spoilers, but it's, there's a disease that spreads all over the world, and suddenly every child dies. Mm. There's no children left. Like, if you've gone through puberty, you are fine, but if you haven't, you'll die.
Okay.
And so several days later, while all the remaining families and parents are like trying to grapple with this huge loss, like this huge catastrophic event, they get up and are like, where am I? They're like buried and stuff. And the kids wake up.
Yeah.
And then they're like, I'm starving. Like, and then they just start walking home and they're like rotting. Ooh. And it's really crazy. It felt very like Pet Cemetery vibes. Yeah. And they have different appetites for, which is blood. Mm-hmm. And what will parents do to keep their children?
Yeah.
Like satiated and with them for longer.
Yeah.
And like at what lengths will they go to?
Interesting.
So it was really weird. It was pretty crazy. And you had different perspectives of different families and like one was a single mom, another one was like the husband and wife couple. They're trying to like deal with it. And one was like a pediatrician who had also suffered his own great loss before any of this stuff had happened. Mm-hmm. But it was really fun.
Interesting.
It was a good one. Yeah. So it definitely had like creepy, spooky vibes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked reading it. I finished it shortly after Halloween. So it was like perfect time for the spooky, creepy book stuff.
Very nice.
Yeah. So, that's about it. I mean, yeah, nothing else.
That sounds like plenty.
Yeah. So you did this recap for this amazing film.
Yeah. Okay. So apologies in advance. Yeah. Tom said that I should like issue like a mass apology for selecting this film.
Did he watch it with you?
He did.
Oh.
Yeah.
Victor didn't watch either of the times I watched.
Yeah.
Because I had to watch it twice. Because I can't read.
So, yeah, I chose this movie because we were trying to come up with a Thanksgiving selection. And we've already, you know, the past few years, we've had some really strong contenders for Thanksgiving selections. But we're starting to run low.
Like You're Next. Oh, my God.
Like Your Next was so movie. Amazing. And The Invitation is so amazing. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of like, oh, we couldn't really come up with any more family dinner or dinner party ones that seemed like good candidates. And The Reaping was a movie that Meredith had never seen. I had seen it a couple of times and remembered enjoying it very much. And it had the title, The Reaping. I was like, hey, it's thematic, you know, it's harvest time. Let's do this. And then upon rewatching it with Tom, I was like, wow, I don't remember this being so god awful. It is god awful. Hey, get it? God awful?
God awful?
Pun intended. And so, but unfortunately, because Meredith and I typically alternate who does the recap, even though she hadn't seen it before, we were planning for her to do the recap. And then when we checked in after she watched it and she's like, are you serious with this shit? She's like, am I recapping this? And so I offered to do it since I felt very penitent that it was such a bad movie. And she accepted. And so I said, okay, I'll do the recap. And then she forgot that we came to this agreement. So I show up today and we had two recaps for one bad movie.
And we're going to read them both. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
No,
we're so not. Buckle up.
So buckle up for some mediocrity. Are you ready?
So The Reaping.
I can't believe I forgot.
That's pretty funny. And I was like, wait, did I misread the text? And so I went back and read them to her. Like, nope. I said, okay.
I was not accusatory. I said I would. I was like, you probably did. That's what I said. I'll take ownership right away. Okay. Messing up. And
so, yeah, it's my fault. Either of us watched it. And it's her fault that both of us recapped it.
It's my fault I watched it twice. Hey. As they say in Italy, Mamma Mia. Amaro.
Ay, Dios mio is how they would put it in Mexico.
Dios mio.
The Reaping was released in 2007. And it has a pretty respectable cast. I mean, Hilary Swank is a multi-time Oscar winner. And I love a lot of her work. I am a big fan of Million Dollar Baby, of Boys Don't Cry. And
I have never seen either of those movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I tend to not... I shy away from movies that I know are depressing.
Mm, so does Tom.
Like a huge bummer. Mm-hmm. Even if they're like, everyone's like, this is a life-changing viewing experience.
Yeah.
Like The Whale and other things. And I'm like, I've already had enough trauma in my life where I'm not like, you know what? Mm-hmm. Yum, yum, yum. And I feel like it's different from like the book I read, for example, or listened to.
Mm-hmm.
That's another realm.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, I know it's ridiculous or.
Well, yeah. Other, and if it's something that couldn't really happen, then it's not going to trigger any actual trauma you've experienced. Yeah.
Right. So continue.
Yeah. But anyway, like there's no disputing that she's an incredibly talented actress.
Yeah.
But she, you know, not every actor or actress makes, never makes a bad choice of a film.
They're like, you know what? This is a car. Or this is a, you know, house for me. I'm going to just do this movie.
And we'll see what happens. Idris Elba is also in it. And this was like, I feel like not before he was big, but...
was he Luther yet?
I don't know, because I didn't watch Luther. But it definitely was before I was aware of him being such a
sexy thirst bitch. Bait
type guy.
I love him.
And he absolutely is in this one. Anna Sophia Robb, as a little girl, she's done some cool stuff since then. She's in the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka movie. She had several significant roles as a child star, and then but has transitioned pretty well to more adult roles as well.
And then there's David Morrissey,
right? Who's not someone that who is that?
He was in The Walking Dead.
Okay,
he was a titular character in that show. Okay.
And then Stephen Rea, who has a very small part in this film as the priest, but is a respectable character actor.
Yeah, he's seen a lot.
So we come to the party with a really respectable cast.
Yeah.
And then let's see what happens at said party.
He didn't become Luther until 2010.
Okay, so this was before.
This is like 3 years later was the when his show came out and he like had a huge
got big.
Yeah.
Okay, so our film begins. A priest is awoken in the night by a smoldering fire appearing on a framed photo in his room. As he investigates other photos, he finds the same woman's face is burned out of each, and when he arranges them on the floor, the pattern of the burn marks makes the shape of an inverted sickle. So, you're like, ooh, it's harvest time.
Harvest time.
I'm really just trying to remind people why I picked this movie.
Thanksgiving.
Yep. Time to, it's pumpkin spice lattes, people.
PSLs. for people who want to be, fast.
Okay. Save time. Okay, so now we're in Concepcion, Chile. Catherine, who is Hilary Swank's character, and Ben, who is Idris Elba's character, they investigate reports of miraculous healing taking place in a crumbling monastery. They inspect the long-dead corpse of a priest that was unearthed in a recent earthquake, and the local faithful are making pilgrimages to this corpse under the misguided belief that it is offering miraculous healing.
Yeah, everyone's tripping balls.
Big time.
Under there.
Way dilated pupils. Mm-hmm. As Catherine and Ben literally dig deeper into the site, they stumble onto hazmat-suited workers of a nearby factory that have been illegally dumping toxic waste in the area. So now we cut to Catherine's lecture to her LSU college class, reporting the story and referring to it as one of the 48 miraculous occurrences I've investigated with 48 scientific explanations. So we're like, so she's a miracle debunker.
Mm-hmm.
Back in her office, Catherine gets a call from the earlier priest, Father Costigan. So this is Stephen Rea's guy, character, if I didn't say that before. And he tells her what happened to his photos of her. He warns her that she's in danger, but she testily brushes him off and immediately falls into a flashback of sickness and death in Africa. Just these random images that we don't have any context for yet. And her daughter in that flashback to Africa, but also whose framed photo is on Catherine's desk. She's snapped out of it by a visit from a gentleman named Doug Blackwell. So this would be Mr. Morrissey's character, who has a problem. He's from Haven, a bayou town where local fishermen found the river water turned to blood. And the town is blaming it on a 12-year-old girl who found her brother dead on the riverbank the day it turned red. This is enough to convince Catherine to go investigate, because basically, like, she doesn't want to help until she finds out that the town is up in arms against this little girl and blaming this little girl for this thing because they're all Bible belters. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, not on my watch, bastards. And off she goes. So she and Ben arrive in Haven and they meet Isabel, their pregnant welcoming committee. And Isabel takes them to the church to meet the mayor. The mayor and Doug take Catherine and Ben to the river, where they take samples of the blood-like water and the dead fish that are floating in it. They boat down the river, then they wade when it gets too shallow, then are exploring the riverbank. Suddenly, Catherine is startled by the appearance of a dirty, mute blonde girl who then runs off. Chasing her, Catherine runs instead into Doug, who tells her that that's Lauren, the girl in trouble that he had told her about. As Catherine and Doug continue to walk, they arrive at the ruins of a church where the town of Haven was originally built before hurricanes destroyed it. Doug points out the mausoleum where they buried their dead before relocating the town to higher ground. And then suddenly all the bayou noises fall silent. And back in the bloody water, Ben is assaulted by bloated frog bodies falling from the sky. Woohoo! Now it's a party.
He's like, perfect. Fall right into the bag of my sample bag.
Save me the effort.
For science.
Yeah. So they pack up their samples and head off to stay at Doug's place, which turns out to be a huge estate that he inherited due to coming, quote, from a long line of only children. The three are enjoying a relaxing cookout that evening, complete with beers and a chat about faith. The fact that Catherine was an ordained minister before losing her faith is mentioned in this conversation. But suddenly, the food cooking on the grill is engulfed in maggots and flies. And as they're cleaning up that mess, they get a phone call from a local farmer whose cattle are acting strange. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. No. Okay.
What?
I was trying to make a joke that, like, the strange behavior of the cattle was like show tunes or something.
Oh, yeah. I hate that.
Damn it.
I'm like, that's weird.
Yeah, Victor, cut that out.
No, keep it in.
Yeah. So as the group is arriving at the farm to check in on this cattle, their truck is rammed by a bull whose attack continues until the farmer shoots it dead.
The bull's like, not on my watch.
Get out of here, assholes. While they inspect the cows that are wasting away, every possible cause that Catherine offers is shot down by the farmer's responses. Later, Ben and Catherine debate the growing alignment of what's happening to the biblical plagues in the book of Exodus. And mm-hmm. Catherine angrily rattles off a well-practiced scientific analysis explaining all the events in ancient Egypt. So you can tell mm-hmm. that this is something that she is familiar with. She has spent a lot of time thinking about, and this is a big thing for her.
Yeah, she's like, basically, that's all bullshit.
It's all bullshit. Like, it was all science, and it was just people, you know, now it's people choosing faith. Back then it was, you know, a lack of understanding and scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
But she's really hot under the collar about it. Like, yeah. She's not just casually like, oh, those silly Egyptians. Like, she's angry.
Yeah, she gets all riled up.
Yeah. Inside the farmer's house, Catherine sees a drawing by his young son that shows Lauren with the cows when she, as the little boy says, made them lie down. Mm-hmm. Next, back outside, Catherine joins a conversation between Doug, the mayor, the sheriff, and the farmer, as the mayor is pushing for action. And in his definition, action is to go after Lauren and her family.
He's like, he's like the definition of a small time Southern mayor. He's like, we don't go to sit back. And watch all this.
What more do you need to see that you've got to get out there in that bayou and take that girl down?
I know. What more do you need? He's like
hitching up his pants,
and he has like a little. He has like a cloth that he's like wiping the sweat off.
Mopping his face.
And I'm like, yeah,
100%. I'd vote for that guy.
Yeah, man.
So. The sheriff admits that they can't tell the cause of death for Lauren's brother, Brody. So the brother that died the day the water turned red, they don't know what killed him. They said that there's no evidence of anything wrong.
Yeah, he just dropped dead.
Yeah, they said that something sucked the life out of him. And then the farmer relates a story of his wife's visit to Lauren's family's house where she saw, I put cultish type things. It was like motorcycles outside. And you're like, okay.
Dr. Frankenfurter's house?
Right? 100%.
Life's pretty cheap for that seller. I can't remember what he
said. Anyway, okay, so now we do just a little bit of a hop back to Father Costigan, seeing that he's being plagued with frightening visions, before we're back with Catherine and Ben at Doug's house that night. When the power goes out, Catherine explores upstairs and notes framed photos of Doug with a wife, as well as a pile of her own published books on a table. From the veranda, she sees a light through the trees, and she follows it outside, and she finds Doug visiting the grave of his wife. He offers Catherine a drink of, quote, something local. And then he shares how his wife had died of cancer. In return, Catherine offers the story of her husband and daughter, how they all went to the Sudan on a mission with Father Costigan, and when the sickness and death persisted, the natives blamed the outsiders, and her husband and daughter were murdered as a sacrifice to God. But before you know it, they're getting hella busy.
Yeah, and I don't understand. It's like, she's like, my husband and daughter they're murdered. But, like, how did she, like, how did Father Costigan and like,
yeah, why weren't they killed?
They're like, we'll see ya.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I guess.
I'm like, that's very weird. Like, yeah. We're gonna do nothing about this, and we'll just, I'm leaving the faith. Goodbye.
After this, you know, sharing their personal loss and trauma, what wouldn't make you horny? Catherine and Doug, you know, take to the sheets. But then she snaps awake. It was all a dream. It's time to make breakfast.
Can I put,
oh no, the eggs are full of blood.
Wait, was she roofied?
Well, that obviously is what we find out at the end did happen. But at this point, they present it like, oh no, it was just a dream.
Oh.
And so she wakes from the dream and then into another dream where when she cracks eggs into a frying pan, they're full of blood. Then she sees Lauren outside. And so she chases after her. And then suddenly she's back in Africa in the middle of a trauma flashback. So this is how we all know that like all of this is dream within a dream within a dream. And so it's just all her memories of her experiences in the Sudan and losing her family. Ben wakes her from this nightmare memory. And she goes to get water from the kitchen and notices her feet are still covered in African sand. So it's like, dun, dun, dun. Was I really there?
Yes.
I don't even know what's real anymore.
Doug, she's like asleep and Doug's like, here, I got this African sand.
I'm going to rub it on the soles of your feet.
Just a ship straight from Africa.
Special for you. Isn't this sexy?
To get you all riled up.
Yep. It's an erogenous zone. The soles of your foot. I don't know that for a fact. I think it's maybe a pressure point.
Maybe, but
some people are into feet.
Well, he knows enough about her, and he read all about her.
Yeah, he did his research.
Then he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna like, I can maybe like mess with her a little bit."
Yeah, you never know.
I just don't think it's real.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, that was kind of a random blip that they threw in there where it's like it never really aligned with anything else.
But did she go to Africa?
I know. No. Like, is that what we're supposed to presume?
Probably not.
Yeah.
She's in Louisiana.
It's unlikely she made that trip and back in this one evening. The next morning, Ben shares the test results that show there's nothing biologically wrong with the cattle or any of their other samples. Meanwhile, Catherine is out trying to visit Lauren's house. And inside, she finds rotting food and bloodstains. It's a real garbage dump. And then she also finds a hidden passage that is marked with the inverted sickle symbol. Mm-hmm. Lauren suddenly appears and Catherine tries to talk with her, including talking with her about becoming a woman as she notices that there is blood running down the inside of Lauren's leg. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every adult woman is just super eager to teach a young girl about her first period. And Catherine is no different.
Especially a swamp child.
100%.
From the swamps.
But this whole time, Lauren remains mute. You don't hear her speak.
No.
Catherine is pulled into another vision of Brody's death. So some of these visions, she's just getting like little snippets of the events surrounding Brody's death and the river changing. And when she snaps out of it, Lauren's gone again. So Catherine returns to exploring the house, and she's startled this time by Lauren's mother, who asks if she's going to kill her baby girl. And this is another, like, she is such a cliche character, just like the sheriff. She's like, are you gonna kill my baby girl? Mm-hmm. And Catherine's like, no, like, what? No. And her mother asks, why not? So she's all, like, crazy, spooky lady.
And then she's like, ugh. Like, that's her face. Ugh.
So, you know, a lot of peculiar behavior amongst the various individuals in this town. And Catherine's trying to talk to the mother before she can get any real answers about Brody's death. Lauren attacks her mother from behind. Her mom gets her restrained and then she orders Catherine out of the house. So that's mm-hmm. that's the end of that discussion.
She's like, go on, get
out of my house. Nailed it.
Okay, I want full disclosure that I'm from Texas. And quite literally, my grandma, she talk like that, you know. I didn't even hear the accent until people pointed it out to me, like different accents that I've grown up listening to.
Well, that's the thing, like, because to me, like, these are, you know, obviously a Louisiana Bayou accent doesn't sound like a Texan accent.
No.
But it's funny how being in California now, people just, it's all Southern. There's no difference.
No.
Because we were actually, a little aside, in my sixth grade literature class, we had read a speech by Lyndon B. Johnson given to Congress to try and get the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. And then there's actual video footage of him giving the address. And so after we read the speech, then we watch that clip.
He sounds Texas.
Absolutely. And he sounds exactly like my grandpa. Although my grandpa was born in and grew up in Missouri, but then he moved to Texas, as an adult.
Yeah.
But spent the majority of his life in Texas. Mm-hmm. But then it always reminds me of the part in The Office where Andy is like, correcting their Southern accents. It's like, what you're doing is a little bit more Tennessee, where if you like New Orleans is more like molasses dripping out your mouth. Yes. So it's a fun thing to play
fun,
around with.
Fun thing to play. It's funny, though, that because David Morrissey, who plays Doug, mm-hmm. and Idris Elba, they're both British.
David Morrissey's British too. Mm-hmm. That's funny.
And they're all, and then also in like Walking Dead, you mm-hmm. know, Andrew Lincoln is also British as well. So it's like all these British people, and the woman who plays Maggie is mm-hmm. also British. So all these British people come in, they're like, "How hard is it? I should play do like a hi." Then suddenly you're Southern. Yeah. It's like a generic little stamp on it. So it just kind of makes me laugh a little bit.
And I'm trying to remember that actor. I feel like his last name is like Polson or something. He was a child actor that like had one of those famous glow ups where like he ended up super super hot, mm-hmm. like the kid from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
He's British, and I didn't know that for a long time because I'd only seen him in American movies. And but I saw a clip one time of him giving an interview, and he's saying that so much of the media that they consume in England is American media, that they're exposed to the American accent or a variety of American accents at such a saturated level that he thinks it actually makes it a little bit easier for British actors to do American accents because they're so exposed to it. Anywho.
All the Southern, get your molasses. So get it, girl, get.
Some okay. sweet tea.
Some sweet tea. Okay, so she skedaddled.
Yeah. I always hear your voice with Jenny in Forrest Gump. Like, you can't see me.
So my grandmother would be like, go on, get. Yeah. Skedaddle.
my grandma that lived in Texas, she was born, she grew up in Colorado for a while and then in Arkansas for, you know, her teen and young adult years and then in Texas. So she was a little muddled, but yeah, it was the way that she pronounced some stuff and the little idioms that they use are pretty adorable.
Dang nabbit. All right, I'm done. Okay, continue. Okay.
Let's see. Okay, so now we're back in town, and Ben and Doug discover the head shearing jamboree happening at the schoolhouse to address the epidemic of lice, the next plague to appear. And the locals are getting more and more agitated, obviously, as the guys head over to check out Brody's body at the morgue.
They're like, how many plagues are we going to have to see?
How many do you need to know that you got to get out in that bayou and kill that girl?
Just a little quick stab.
Stabby stab. Okay, so they find suddenly that Brody's body is partially mummified. Ben's like, you wouldn't see this. The body's been in the ground for two, three years. So, like, obviously not a normal decomposition process happening to
it's
Brody's
a wild
body.
Yeah, decomp, he said.
So there are no answers to be found there, except they do note that there is the sickle shape is scarred into Brody's back. The next bombshell is the lab report showing that the samples from the river are, in fact, human blood. So at this point, Catherine, you're still trying to get a read on whether or not Catherine is being at all convinced. If she's being swayed from her determination to find the scientific explanation, no matter how many coincidences, no matter how much it looks like it's supernatural, she came into this game determined that there's not possible for it to be supernatural. But every now and then you get a little bit of an inkling that maybe she's starting to be doubtful.
Yeah.
And so here she calls Father Costigan, and he starts schooling her on some research he's been doing on an ancient satanic group where the firstborn child is branded and left unharmed to carry on the bloodline while the secondborn children are sacrificed. So Catherine questions why Lauren would still be alive then as a secondborn child, and Father Costigan offers another element of their philosophy that the cult's reward would be would be a perfect child that would be a secondborn who, when coming into adulthood, would be reborn with the eyes of Satan. And then he says also at the height of the cult's power that God would send an angel to destroy them. And so Father Costigan suggests that angel is Catherine right before his whole room bursts into flames and he's killed in a fire, which reminded me, that's what happens in, this was reminding me a lot of the priest in Amityville.
Oh,
like yeah. the whole Father Costigan kind of not, it's not a side story, but that supporting element of like feeding the information and the religious angle from this guy really reminded me of the priest in the Amityville movies. Mm-hmm. And so like throughout this conversation, when she gets the report saying that the river is blood and she goes to call Father Costigan, I feel like you kind of think like, oh, now she's starting to believe that maybe it really is supernatural. But then in her conversation with Father Costigan, it sounds like, no, she still believes that this is just an insane cult and she needs to protect this little girl from these horrible people, and she's trying to understand what their beliefs are, what they're doing. So now Ben and Doug managed to convince the sheriff to not go out after Lauren, but to instead try to get the mayor to order an evacuation of the town. But when they go find the mayor, I said, oops, it's Boyles. So the mayor and all of his council members are just laying like, are they dead? Are they just incapacitated, but they're just covered in boils?
Seems not like a well thought out plan, like reveal.
Yeah. Well, and it was just that group of people. Like, nobody else experiences boils. And at the same time, like, the lice, like, the school children getting lice, it was, like, just them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if maybe they were doing it in that manner to make it seem, to support the idea that it was possible that it was just scientific and that it was just a coincidence. Because school children get lice, you know? And so making it a group of children, like, admittedly, like, a large number of children suddenly getting lice all at once. But it wasn't like the entire town woke up with lice.
Yeah.
Okay, so you could be like, if you were really trying to not believe that this was God, then you'd be like, okay, well, school kids, there's lice at schools. We all know that. It's a sad fact. And so with the Boyles thing, like, it being isolated to that group of people is kind of bizarre, but then maybe that supports that, like, okay, well, there's something in this office, and that's why it only affected this group of people that were exposed. Or maybe I'm giving them too much credit for the thought that they put into writing this film.
I don't think they did, but continue.
Okay. So the Boyles is all the sheriff needs to see to gather the posse. And I put, yay, good old boys in trucks with guns. Catherine actually gets to Lauren's house first, and she ventures into the hidden cellar room that she couldn't go into before, finding all kinds of culty sacrificial goodies. She encounters Lauren's mom. They have a nice chat. And then Lauren's mom shoots herself in the head. Then that's all we need to know about that.
No one cares.
Yeah. And through these conversations and going back, it feels like they're trying to do a lot of misdirection about, like, is Lauren Satan? Is she the evil one? Is she a victim? Does Catherine believe? Is there a scientific explanation? And so the comments that Lauren's mom makes on these two occasions when Catherine talks to her, I think are intentionally supposed to be vague and up for interpretation. Like, they could be interpreted multiple ways.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, I'm not going to bother actually writing down what she says.
Yeah. I mean, I might say no one cares, but I'm like, she's seemed like an afterthought. Like, oh, here, I'm here to be, I'm a red herring. Ooh, look at me.
over here, bang.
You're like, oh, okay. Well, anyway.
So Lauren is there now. And both Lauren and Catherine hear the posse and their trucks pull up outside. But soon there's something else outside, too. Locusts. Fun times. So Catherine goes outside just as Doug and Ben also pull up in their vehicle. And they find Lauren is standing in the middle of the farmhouse yard, surrounded by, at the time, relatively calm insects. And all of the men's guns trained on her. But when a shotgun is cocked, the bugs rise and violently swarm all the men. So it's like they're doing Lauren's bidding. They're protecting her. So Catherine takes shelter in the house while Doug and Ben race into the woods. Doug dives into the bloody river and Ben ends up hiding in the mausoleum in the church ruins. Ben and Catherine are communicating via walkie-talkie when Ben finds the bodies of all the secondborns hanging in the crypt. The two of them plan to meet at the truck to get away, but then Ben finds that he's trapped in the mausoleum because Lauren is outside, and then suddenly their communication with each other is lost. Catherine rushes to the crypt and finds Ben's dead body. So sad.
I know.
Such I'm like, a huge Zelda, loss.
You're the only redeeming part of this movie.
You are the one that should have survived all of it. yeah, and he really does, like... You could say that as a joke, but, like, his character actually had depth. You get a little bit of a backstory to him.
Yeah, he's a bad boy.
But then, you know, like, had his near-death experience, found his faith, and then, you know, that he's a Christian that actively participates in debunking miracles, but he has, you know, his own... he's a really pretty rich character. Mm-hmm. But now he's dead.
But now that's gone.
It's all over. And I'm sad. So now Doug appears, and Catherine pledges to him to, quote, end this, presumably by killing Lauren with the dagger that she kept from the cellar. As she approaches Lauren outside, two more plagues arrive, darkness and fire from the sky. And then she attacks, and just as she's about to stab Lauren, she's granted one final vision, and it shows the cult, dun-dun-dun, including Doug, he's part of it, trying to sacrifice Lauren. So all along, she's been getting just little glimpses into the events of that day. And now she sees the whole story. And that is that they were trying to sacrifice Lauren, and she escaped. And they sent her brother after her. I said she escapes and runs. She's pursued by her brother. And when he catches up with her at the edge of the river and stabs her, not only does her wound disappear, but the life is stripped from his body because he stabbed her. Then as the water drips from her...
Well, he was kind of a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't seem like the best big brother out there. The water's drifting away from her feet, turning to blood. And then we hear Father Costigan's words in a voiceover to indicate that rather that Lauren being the satanic payoff that everybody was looking for, she is actually the angel that was sent to destroy the cult. So they're like, this is supposed to be your what moment. But I think that it was... things were so confusing up until that point that they didn't really get that shocking payoff that they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, that's putting it mildly. Okay. So I said, well, now here's Doug trying to gaslight Catherine, but she's not falling for it. She's recalling all the comments.
He's like, she's evil.
You gotta kill her. Don't you see? Don't let her trick you.
She's trying to blind you to the truth, Catherine. Remember that sexy night we had? Wait, what?
Yeah, she's thinking about all... They flash back to all these comments that people have made throughout the movie that now kind of hold new meaning with Catherine's belief now that Lauren is an angel rather than Satan. And so she also figures out somehow in that moment that it was Doug that killed Ben. I put, that son of a bitch.
We all hate Doug.
Fuck you, Doug. that was not rehearsed.
No.
So, Catherine...
The feelings were real.
Yeah, it was 100% genuine. Mm-hmm. Catherine is ready to run to safety with Lauren, but now the rest of the cult has arrived, which is not great. So Doug takes a different tactic, admitting that, yes, they all serve Satan, and he's playing on Catherine's own fallen faith to draw her to their side. Like, what has your God ever done for you? He took your family from you. We have a Lord that always answers his people's prayers and all that bullshit. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't work either, and time's up. The final plague arrives, and the entire cult, which are all firstborns, are destroyed by this final plague. And I'm assuming we knew that Lauren wasn't a firstborn. At no point in the movie do they indicate to us that Catherine has an older sibling, but mm-hmm. maybe it's all she, since she's an outsider, it wouldn't apply to her anyway. Mm-hmm. But the two of them are safe, mm-hmm. basically, from this final plague. So now that they are safe, Catherine and Lauren head out of town. And as they drive, Catherine promises that the two of them will take care of each other. And in one of the few times in this movie when Anna Sophia Robb actually speaks, Lauren asks, what about the boy inside you? The baby. We'll have to take care of him too. And Catherine's like, duh. And she hears Costigan's voice again talking about the perfect evil second born and remembers the dream of hooking up with Doug. That was maybe dot, 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 not a dream after all. Dot, dot, dot. And then that's the end.
and then that's the end.
So we still don't know what's going on. but at least the movie's over.
I know.
So Meredith. Did you think this was scary?
No.
Did you think this had any redeeming qualities whatsoever?
Idris Elba, maybe. That's it.
Okay, that's fair.
I liked him.
Yeah.
Okay, it's funny because I had never seen this movie, And they're like, okay, she's like, I'm an LSU professor. I'm debunk stuff. I don't give a crap. Like that's her.
Yeah.
Catherine in a nutshell. And then Doug shows up and he's like, this is happening. I was like, he's fucking in charge of this shit. He's a bad guy.
He's the one doing it. Can I turn this off now?
That guy's a piece of shit. Like immediately.
Yeah.
Like, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And then everything played out. They're like, it was him. I'm like, yeah, I know. He's an asshole. And well, I don't know. Like, I doubt anyone probably would have felt the same way. I'm like, fuck that guy.
Well, yeah, I think that probably most horror movie fans would have been suspicious of him perhaps at different points throughout the movie, maybe not that immediately. And I think that what they thought that they were doing was, like you say, like red herrings or mm-hmm. like to try and keep you guessing and mm-hmm. make you suspect this person, but then not suspect this person, then suspect that person.
Yeah.
They were trying to make it like complex and mysterious.
Well, no. No, that didn't work. No, I just felt like it felt like an early 2000s movie that was trying to be like, oh, you know, we're going to be edgy and, you know, there's like religion and plagues and who knows.
We're
going to
be edgy by
happen.
Going Old Testament.
I know, we're edgy and then we're going to have crazy techno music at the end and like, it's like, do I have the son of Satan? Do
They're
I have
like,
a
we
Satan
couldn't get
satanic?
Moby, but this is almost
it's
as
like,
good.
It's like, at the end. And I was like, oh, thank God that's over.
Here, let me watch it again and write notes on it.
Apparently, I just was a glutton for punishment mm-hmm. who didn't know how to read. But no, not scary.
Not good.
Not really good.
Yeah.
Maybe if they had more depth with the little girl character, it feels like the director's like, just stand there and look with your big blue eyes and look fucking creepy like Damien from The Omen.
Mm-hmm.
And be like, ooh, is she evil? Who knows? And she's like, just kind of like, ugh. Like I'm looking at Katie right now, like
big old big googly eyes.
I'm like, look at this,
getting and your first period all over the place.
Yeah, and like don't say anything that could rationally explain anything to mm-hmm. anybody, especially this new lady who's like here, I'm here to help you. But like, no, and like you know, and look creepy and ominous.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they're like, look creepy and ominous.
That's
and,
it.
And then Full we're stop. Gonna we're gonna have intermittent weird visions from Catherine, mm-hmm. and there's gonna be blood water a lot, lots of blood water mm-hmm. happening, and that's it.
And that's it.
And that gives you a movie. Yeah. I don't know. It's not your finest choice, but
no.
But,
and I don't really have an explanation.
Well, no, you don't want me to besmirch Leprechaun, but I liked it better than Leprechaun.
And that I don't understand. Because I don't even like this better than Leprechaun. So I honestly, like I said, I'd seen it a couple of times before.
You found it compelling.
Yeah, I liked it enough on those occasions to suggest it. Not because I thought it was the best horror movie ever made, but it had a thematic title and I remembered enjoying it. And so trying to determine like any redeeming value that it is, because we know that there's such a depth of horror movies that draw on Christianity and Catholicism as yeah. their fodder. And it's because so many of the elements of that faith are already like they're built for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
built with evil and prophecies and cultish behavior and ceremonies and rites and sacrifices. Like that's all already part of the Christian faith mm-hmm. and the history. And so it's almost like a gimme to make a horror movie out of it. Like it shouldn't be too hard.
Yeah, well, let me go back really quickly because I really liked the movie Stigmata mm-hmm. and I thought it was really good. And then I rewatched it and I was like, no, this is not good.
I shouldn't rewatch it is what you're saying. Because I saw it in the theater and I don't think I've seen it since. That had Gabriel Byrne, right? Mm-hmm. And Patricia Arquette.
And that was in the early 2000s as well.
Okay.
So I'm like, was this just like, you know, money? People like to watch this crap. So yeah. they're just throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping, you know, like I'm like, what went into making this? Was it on the heels of other movies that was like similar? Mm-hmm. And they're like, we have a really good cast. Like maybe it could be a successful you know, film, but that, yeah. that doesn't equal good. But I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. Maybe that's
like I'm trying to find something, grasping at straws, as they say.
Right.
And so I, to my knowledge, I don't know if there are any other horror movies that utilize the biblical plagues. And I don't know that it's the first person that was like, hey, the plagues are scary. I don't know if they were on the right track. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could have made a movie differently that would have made the biblical plagues scary, because they, some of them should be, you yeah. know, blood, water turning to blood, that can be scary. Like the death of the firstborn, like you could use that in a scary way. Lice, I don't know. Pestilence, you know, like.
How much do you hate bugs?
How much do you hate bugs? But one of the things that I do like about this movie that they did entirely by accident is I love this setting, this Louisiana bayou, like, it seemed like the one of my favorite places in Disneyland is the French, do they call it French Quarter? No, I can't remember. No, it's,
I think so. I don't remember.
It's now like, I'm blanking on what the place in Disneyland where Pirates and Haunted Mansion is. New Orleans Square. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. But it is. It's supposed to be reflective of the French Quarter. And I've never been to New Orleans. I've always been kind of fascinated and romanticized it. I thought for a while about going to Tulane, but then I realized I can't handle humidity. and so I think that that setting really appeals to me. And so I that might be one of the things that I liked about this movie, because there's another horror movie I don't know if you've seen that has a similar setting called The Skeleton Key. With Kate Hudson. That movie. Yes, I love that and movie I love, too.
Like, I love voodoo and mm-hmm. I love like, yeah, that's really fun. Those kinds of homes where they mm-hmm. have like the big plantation homes mm-hmm. are, and especially if they're haunted or weird shit's happening. I'm like,
I want to live there so bad.
Let me see. I'd be dead in an hour because I'd be like sweating my life away.
Right. Completely dehydrated. Have to be on an IV at all times.
Get my fainting couch. I can't handle this.
But like, yeah, when she, in this movie, when Catherine is like looking around upstairs and she walks out onto the veranda, I'm just thinking, damn, I want that veranda.
I know.
Like, that's like, it's got a record player going and the little rail. I'm like, I would spend my entire life on that veranda. Looking yeah. at those gorgeous droopy trees.
Drink your mint julep and be like, I do declare it.
And be like, there's so many cicadas this
so
year.
So many cicadas. I can't sleep during my 4 o'clock slumber.
I do declare.
Everyone hates us.
Yep. and so I think the, you know, the setting, habitat, but then while his estate had that southern, that bayou kind of Louisiana feel, the town itself didn't really feel.
It just felt small town.
Yeah, it was southern small town. Like it didn't
like the
have
crazies,
a.
The craziest
little bit.
Small town.
Yeah.
Just like a, you know, high school houses all next to each other that looked, mm-hmm. you know, white picket fences, normal.
Yeah, there wasn't anything about it that, like, spoke to the bayou or Louisiana or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's another one that. You know, falls into that category, I think, is Last Exorcism.
Yeah, yeah.
Where that's not quite so bayou, and it doesn't have, like, the big, gorgeous house. But I do like that. I like that setting for a horror movie. I think it puts you in the right mood.
Yeah.
For something spooky to happen.
And I'm ready for it.
100% ready but for it.
But, I didn't
but
get
this
it.
One
didn't get anything.
Yeah.
Didn't get it.
And so I asked you before we started, and I don't know if you have an answer for this one or if I have an answer for this one, but with this movie, like, we know that it had a great cast. We know that it had a serviceable setting. What did it do most wrong? Like, is there anything you could pinpoint to and say, if you fixed that, this might have been a better movie?
I feel like the twist was too obvious,
mm-hmm.
maybe just for me, but I feel like maybe for a lot of people. I feel like some of the dialogue was disconnected.
Okay.
And I feel like some of it was just lazy. Well, I mean, like, more directing the little girl look creepy.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like there could have been more depth to
that her character
a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, it's for me, it would be like, because that's kind of the story,
mm-hmm.
right? The story needed more clarity,
mm-hmm.
And more finesse.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can predict the twist in any movie. So you're not really a good barometer for that. But yeah. this was predictable to a lay person like me.
I'm a terrible mother.
Why?
Because we went to go see the second Beetlejuice movie.
Yeah.
And then I noticed something.
I haven't seen it.
I won't say anything, but I'm going to say I noticed something. And then I whispered it to my family. And that was the twist.
You suck.
I'm like, I just want to, it just burst out of me. I was like, hey. And they're like, damn it, Mom.
Well, that was like with the new Candyman. I saw that before you. And I was like, oh, it's got a twist that you're totally going to see coming. And it wasn't even like you saw it coming. You just noticed his name.
Yes.
Which I heard his name and I'm like, yep, whatever. That's a pretty common name. And didn't make the connection at all.
You're like, did you notice? I was like, that his name was
this. That he was the baby because that was his name.
Yes.
I'm like, damn you, Meredith.
Shut up with your memory and knowing things.
Get out of here.
I will get out of here. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that the story is probably where this fell. And along with that, the script. Like you say, maybe some of the dialogue was shitty. But again, like the script can only be as good as the story.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a totally bad idea. Like she's brought in to go investigate mm-hmm. some weird stuff happening. It turns out the whole town is in on a cult. Mm. And a cult is happening. And that reveal wasn't really as big as it should have been. They're like, oh yeah, well yeah, we do this shit all the time. Mm-hmm. It should have been like more like she's investigating, she's talking to neighbors, and then she notices something weird like in someone's home or like little tidbits of something. Not like No information. Here's a big reveal. We're all in on it.
Yeah. And you're I think that's where they needed clarity because they weren't all in on it.
But like
some of them were. No, not most of them. I don't think.
Well, I had like all these people, like the pregnant people. And they're like, we don't.
Because she's that was only like one woman.
Oh, because someone else was too. I don't remember. Anyway, who cares?
Well, maybe you're right. But that's the thing is, I think that it wasn't clear. Like, to me, at the end, you know, when that group shows up, it's like, that couldn't have been the whole town, right? Yeah. And then the other thing that they don't ever really explain is that if Doug was part of this cult and, in fact, a leader, like, I think when in his big monologue at the end, he indicates that his family, like, or his grandfather or whatever is kind of, like, the leader, why did he bring Catherine in? And it was like, Catherine says at the end, like, you need me to kill her because you already tried and failed. And then I think he like kind of indicates that because she was a person of the cloth, that she'd be able to do it when they couldn't. And so like his whole thing was to bring her in and manipulate her into killing Lauren. But and then and
it just that's why I it just seemed contrived. And I'm like, yeah. No.
And then like, not, was Lauren the angel or was Catherine the angel? Because Lauren is not the Antichrist, but the fetus is the Antichrist. And then so are they both angels sent by Satan to protect the Antichrist? And is this all about abortion?
and then in my recap, I go, does she have a Satan baby?
question mark.
Satan baby.
The reaping too. Satan baby.
Back in the habit.
Oh my god. Yeah. So again, I apologize.
That's okay
for yeah, this movie.
I mean, as I said before we recorded, I've made you watch weird movies.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
And what I was thinking was that, like, I still think this is kind of a unique situation because the weird movies that the couple of movies you had me watch that I'd never seen before, because you mentioned House of the Devil, which I actually enjoyed a lot. Mm-hmm. And then Jacob's Ladder, which while mm-hmm. I was kind of like unsure about, I still recognize like it had a lot of merit. And I know that it is a cult classic. And so I was not going to be dismissive of it. The ones that we have watched for you mm-hmm. That I hated were ones I'd already seen, like Dracula. And I'm like, I don't even know if there have been other ones.
You're not a fan of vampires. Which I think that's just a preference thing too. Yeah. Although you did like 30 Days of Night, right? Like
I that did. And I think that when we were talking about those movies, we identified because those are very different kind of vampire.
It's a totally different beast.
Yeah, vampires aren't my thing.
Yeah. But
that's okay.
I love vampires.
Yes, I know you do.
I love it. Man.
Yes.
The Interview with a Vampire is what caught me when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I read that book and I was like, ooh, this is sneaky. I was trying to be sneaky reading it.
That was the first Pacifica Mothers Club book club meeting I ever went to, was when we read Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We did?
Mm-hmm.
I have no recollection of that.
Yeah. You did not speak to me that night.
No,
many nights after.
I was probably like, I don't need to talk to her.
Yeah. And I remember that was, since I know Florence doesn't listen all the way to the end of the episodes, but she was dressed as a vampire that night. And it was, remember when her hair was super short like mine is now?
Yeah.
But her hair is so much thicker, so it had like so much more volume.
Yeah.
That was the Florence I met that night.
Yeah, she looked like Eddie Munster a little bit.
I hope she doesn't listen all the way to the end.
I'll tell her.
I'll tell her to her face.
So I forgot there's something interesting news related that we should share.
Okay.
Which I'm really excited about. And it's definitely a horror movie.
Do I know about it?
I don't know. I was going to ask you, then I forgot. So now I'm asking you live on the air. Okay, so because the Exorcist movie was kind of a flop, the new one.
Oh, a Believer.
It was kind of a Believer. That it was supposed to be, I think it was supposed to be three movies, and it was kind of scrapped.
Okay.
Okay. Guess who's at the helm of doing it now?
The way you're saying it, I feel like it's got to be Danny McBride.
No.
Jordan Peele.
No. He's my other one who I always say he's my boyfriend.
Mike Flanagan?
Mm-hmm.
Sweet.
So I saw 2025, Mike Flanagan, The Exorcist. It's going to be his. He's writing it. He's doing everything.
Is it a reboot or is it a continuation of the same story?
I think it's a whole separate story.
Okay.
But I could be mistaken. I've only read like tidbits about it, but I was like, oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
And it's like big, big budget. It's going to be probably amazing. So I was bummed out because I never actually watched The Exorcist Believer because you said it was pretty, you know.
It was meh.
It was okay.
Yeah.
But so I never watched it. And then so I saw that news and I was like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, when you find out news like that where something you're really excited about and someone that you tend to really enjoy and appreciate their work, then it's, you know, just gets you all riled up and excited.
Stars align.
Yeah. So I was like, ooh, I got to tell Katie. And then I forgot. So now I'm telling you.
Yay. So, no, that sounds
some
exciting.
Some good news.
Yeah.
In the horror genre.
Horror world. Yeah. Well, I'll be curious to see, because this, during October in my classroom, I put up all of my, my horror movie Funko Pops.
Yeah.
And then this year I actually bought as a gift to myself. It's like it was a little mini pop, or pocket pop, whatever they call it. Pseudo advent calendar for Halloween, so it was like 13.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had it in my classroom and I opened them, like, you know, one, not one each day, but one each school day leading up to Halloween, and all four of the classes that come into my room were really enjoyed it, and we wasted a lot of instructional time talking about horror movies throughout the month of October.
You're like, oh man, oh well. what are you gonna do?
But it's fun because they do ask me, you know, what's it about and why, what did she do and why is that bad? And a lot of it, some of it I, you know, sanitize or I, you know, just give them general ideas.
Developmentally appropriate, sure.
Yes. Because like, for example, one of the full size Funko Pops I have is Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that as like, she's actually on one of my slides for National Anti-Bullying Day. Because they were like, why is she covered in blood? And I was like, well, she was a high school student that got bullied, like really, really bad. I was like, but the thing is, she was telekinetic, so she could move things with her mind. Mm-hmm. And so when the bullies went too far and dumped gross stuff on her, she killed them all.
There was a bit of a jape that happened. Bit of a jape that went bad.
Yeah. Oopsie. But what made me think of that was one of the other ones that I have a full-size Funko Pop of, and then I got a mini one in this Advent thing what is Reagan from The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. And so when I got the mini one, or I show them, and then they would be like, well, but which one is she? Because those of them that have any concept of it, most of them that have any concept at all, think that Exorcist Believer is the Exorcist movie, because it's the only one that's come out in their lifetime that they might be aware of. And they're like, but there were two girls. I'm like, fuck all of you. Get out of here.
And it's like when you see the meme when someone's like, oh my gosh, so-and-so. Oh, shoot. What's his name? Sean Astin from, he's from Stranger Things. And they're like, no, he's from Lord of the Rings, you infant or you fetus. And mm-hmm. like, no, he's from the Goonies, you pieces of crap.
Well, and there's a phase in between that, too. There's Rudy in between that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, but yeah, like I've seen that, too, where you can identify what generation you're in by what you know Sean Astin from.
Yeah, and then I'm like, ah. No, he's from the Goonies.
100%.
Although, I love the Lord of the Rings. But anyway, I digress. I'm excited about this. And then I also saw a trailer for a Steven Soderbergh. It's called, I think it's like Ghost or Haunting. Or so. It's like a scary movie. Mm-hmm. And it's, but like highbrow, I think.
Okay.
And Steven Soderbergh. Snooty. I mean, of course, he wrote The Social Network and other like Oscar-winning movies. So I'm always interested when these people who don't typically do horror, like what they would do.
Yeah, what they're going to bring to the table that might be different as we haven't seen before.
Sometimes it's fantastic and I'm really excited, or sometimes I'm like, no.
No, thank you.
No, thanks. I don't need that.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Alrighty.
So I had to bring that to the table after our reaping discussion.
Yeah, let's point our faces towards something more hopeful.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't have any fun facts about this movie.
There's nothing fun about
this. Fun fact, I watched it twice by mistake.
Fair enough.
Then we Rochambeau'd before the podcast to see who had to
recap. Yeah, and so on that note, happy Thanksgiving to our listeners. We hope that this was an appetite whetting conversation.
At least it gets you hungry for some beignets. Some beignets and some...
That's for the town folk.
That's for the town. I'm excited about our next project.
Yes.
Well, I mean, episodes. It's in our extended episode.
Yeah. The idea came to me actually because when I was thinking about this movie and its biblical origins, and then obviously as a Catholic school teacher, I teach religion.
The birth of Christ all the time. And all that.
And we read the Bible and we try to interpret and apply biblical stories to our lives. And because of my perspective and my beliefs, fact that so many of our students aren't actually Catholic, just trying to, like, how can we interpret from this a message about how to be good people is basically how I approach everything.
Mm-hmm. That's silly.
Being a good person? because if you're not a good person, you'll drown in a flood.
How can I get what I want?
Yeah.
Treat people like trash.
Yeah, treat people like trash. But anyway, so there some of these, I think people make movies about these biblical topics because they are kind of fascinating and weird. And then when you actually start, like, learning about them and everything, it's just always weirder than you thought it was, the more you learn. Mm-hmm. And so I got this, like, well... since I picked this terrible movie, like maybe we could link it to some other better movies that utilize like biblical origins or whatever in a different way, aside from just the whole demonic possession and you need a priest.
Yeah.
Which is how it appears like 90% of the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it made me think of a movie I had seen recently two movies that I've seen recently that I really liked both of them. And they have very like kind of polar opposite approaches to the same thing that is very Christmassy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so the first Omen, we talked about very briefly back when we watched it.
Yeah.
We were, talking about so it was like a what's new with you, like, oh, I watched First Omen, but I loved it. And I think mm-hmm. I saw it first, but then you saw it too and you also loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those things where I saw they were making it and I was like, eh. And then I watched it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is really good.
Yeah.
I found it compelling, very well written and amazing acting, and it was great.
Yeah. And it's one of the really, really beautiful moments where they make a prequel that that is perfectly respectful mm-hmm. and aligns with the original movie mm-hmm. in a way. Because so often, if you're a fan of an original, you hate all the sequels or you hate all the prequels because they don't honor the story or the message or the characters of the original. And this one, like the first Omen, not only on the timeline perfectly aligns with the original Omen film that Gregory Peck made, mm-hmm. but it's also a really creative and interesting and scary shit story
yeah.
that actually enhances the story from the original movie rather than contradicting it or like ripping it off or whatever. Mm-hmm. They came up with their own idea that adds to the scariness of the whole universe of the Omen.
Yeah, it wasn't lazy.
No,
it was fantastic.
It was not.
So I watched it and I was like, oh man, I watched it by myself
mm-hmm.
and I was like, Victor, this was like, and say, like, I didn't even say, hey, I want to watch this with me, because I thought it would be like, eh, you know, like I was doing other stuff and yeah. watching it. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to pay attention and watch this, like, you know, not divert my attention and
yeah.
you know, stay off my phone and just like fully watch this. Because, yeah, I hope everyone likes it who hasn't seen it.
Yeah.
Probably check it out.
And then but it's going to be a twofer episode because the other one. So both of these movies were released in 2024. But I saw the first Omen in the theater with Tom, actually. And then the other one I just watched on streaming recently that's called Immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and now I'm totally blanking on that actress's name who's on Euphoria, that Sydney Sweeney.
Yeah, she's like big blue eyes.
Yeah, she's like a familiar. Much more voluptuous Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah,
she's got the really big eyes. But I love her on Euphoria.
Mm-hmm.
And so she made this film, and it's like, oh, Immaculate, and in all the imagery, you know, around the film, she has like a nun's, you know, garb habit on, and so I'm like, okay, so this is Catholic, this is religious in its theme as well. And so I watched it, and while it was not as good as the first Omen,
mm-hmm.
it was very intriguing. And I think that when you couple it with First Omen, it's just super fun
mm-hmm.
to look at these two movies side by side.
They came out basically at the same time also,
yeah.
like very, very close. I kept getting confused, honestly. I was like, what's the new Omen movie, Immaculate? No, that's wrong. I don't know. Anyway.
I feel like I wasn't aware of Immaculate until much more recently, because I feel like I watched it pretty soon after I first became aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so spoiler alert, they both have to do with conception.
Mm-hmm.
of some sort, mm-hmm. Which is why I felt like they would be appropriate selections for our Christmas episode
mm-hmm.
this year.
Yeah. And I said, good idea.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, woohoo.
And then I forgot. Wait,
and,
no,
and then we both wrote four recaps of three wrong movies.
Leprechaun, Back in the Hood. That's not even Christmas related.
Yeah, that's okay. that'll be what you're hearing from us next time.
Yes.
So definitely watch them both.
Yeah. You won't be disappointed.
No.
They're great.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're at it, watch Oddity also.
Oh, just a little last minute plug there. I still haven't watched that.
Oh, watch it.
But I agree that I want to see Heretic as well.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited to watch that. okay. All right. Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye.